Blog Talk Radio.
Wake up, everybody, no more sleeping in bed. No more back to thinking, time for thinking ahead. The world has changed so very much from what it used to be. There's so much hatred, war and poverty. Oh, 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 oh. Wake up, all the teachers, time to teach a new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you have to say. They're the ones who's coming up, and the world is in their hands. When you teach the children, teach them the very best you can. But just let it be. Na 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 na. The world won't get no better. We gotta change it now, just you and me. Wake up all the doctors, make the old people well. They're the ones who suffer and who catch all the hair. But they don't have so very long before their judgment day. So won't you make them happy before they pass away. Wake up all the builders, time to build a new land. I know we could do it if we all lend a hand. The only thing we have to do is put it in our minds. Surely things will work out, they do it every time. Let it be. The world won't get no better. We gotta change it, just you and me. Need a little help, y'all. Yes, I do. Need a little help. Say it, boy. Need some help, y'all. I'll change the world. What it used to be. Can't do it alone.
Can't do it alone.
Need some help, yeah.
Need some help, yeah.
That's right. Wake up, everybody. No more sleeping in the bed. We got too much work ahead, and we welcome you to Missing Pages of History Radio, MPH Radio. As the voice of MPH Radio, we present to you the missing pages of African/Black soldiers in the U.S. Civil War. That's going to be our major topic for today. And we're going to have our special guest who will speak to that topic, our brother Ernest McBride. We will talk about him coming up shortly. But in the meantime, like always, the agenda for today's program will entail giving you something to think about as it relates to freedom, MPH Black Benefactors by Susie. Then we have a special segment called The World is Talking. And then followed by our guest today in our theme, The Missing Pages of African/Black Soldiers in the U.S. Civil War. And like always, we'll close our program out with a message from Alex and how you can support MPH Radio. So like always, let's get started with today's program. And we ask you to take out your pen, your pencil, and some paper. And we want to give you something to think about as it relates to this concept of freedom. Freedom is something that millions and millions of people have died over and continue to die over. But different people may have different perspectives of what it is. So I think it becomes very important for us as a people to have a proper understanding. What do we mean by freedom? So we're going to give you a working definition to think about and see how it applies to your life when it comes to the concept of freedom. And we say that freedom is having the ability and the means to control those necessities for life. That's right. We said freedom is having the ability and the means to control those necessities for life. What do you think about that concept of freedom and how does it apply to your daily life? So at this point in time, we have given you something to think about as it relates to freedom, the concept of freedom. We're going to move on right now to our Black Benefacts for this week with Sister Susie. Sister Susie, welcome to MPH Radio.
Good evening. Today's Black Benefacts is coming from the PRSP calendar of 2024. And we're going to start with March the 24th, where the African students rose against neocolonialists closing university in Madagascar in 1971. On the 25th, Selma March reached its state capital in Montgomery, Alabama in 1965. On the 26th of March, Ahmad Sekou Touré died in 1984. On the 27th, Shirley Graham Du Bois, author and Pan-Africanist, died in 1977. And on the 28th, in 1958, W.C. Handy, one of the most important figures in the 20th century U.S. popular music history, died. And finally, for the last date of this week, the 24th through the 30th, we have in 1870, the 15th Amendment granting African men in the U.S. the right to vote is formally adopted into the U.S. Constitution. I've just given you some mini facts from the PRSP calendar of 2024.
Susan, we'd like to thank you for your MPH Black mini facts. We hope people are taking a heed to it. And remember that history must be understood as a tool where people can learn from and help them to come to a better understanding of the past, the present, and to help them to map out the future. The African community and the various underserved communities that we represent, we have a very historical, powerful history, powerful past, and we must learn it. We thank you, Susan, for your MPH Black Benefacts. And right now, we can go into a new segment from time to time called The World is Talking. We're going to play an article that was produced by Palestinian youth and student organizations on May the 7th, titled, It is Time for the Palestinian Leadership to Go. They are speaking to the world, and we thought this message was worthy to bring to you today to listen to. So right now, we're going to play this message, and we'll be right back. This is MPH Radio. Hear the message.
May 7th, 2020. It is time for the Palestinian leadership to go. Arabic to follow. Palestinian youth and student organizations. It is time for the Palestinian leadership to go. We, the undersigned Palestinian youth and student organizations, and with us the associations, organizations, and institutions that have signed this statement, call on the masses of Palestinian youth and students throughout occupied Palestine and in exile to join us in a popular initiative for the advancement and initiation of national development for the restoration of the revolutionary democratic approach for a new stage of struggle. The core of this initiative is the objectives of our Palestinian people, return, liberation, and continuing struggle to achieve all of their legitimate national goals and aspirations, no matter how long it may take. The cause of Palestine, the sacred cause of our people, the cause of the exploited popular classes in our Arab homeland and the forces of freedom in the world, is today intended for liquidation, to be uprooted from the awareness and memory of our people and our nation. Rights of our people everywhere are subjected to all forms of distortion and confiscation. Nothing will protect this great cause from the ravages of liquidation and destruction except for the minds and arms of our people, the will of the committed, patriotic and revolutionary youth, and the steadfastness of women, workers, and peasants. Therefore, today, we call on our Palestinian people, especially the young Palestinian generations, to reject and repudiate the policies and positions represented in the approach of Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas and his cohort, and to affirm that the leadership of the Palestinian Authority does not represent our people and is outside the ranks of our national struggle. We also call upon our great people to embody this popular will on the ground by organizing the widest, unified popular framework to overcome the disastrous phase of Oslo and all of its accompanying effects. We invite you to participate broadly in the overthrow of the program of the so-called Palestinian leadership, which is based on a path of surrender and abandonment. This corrupt approach has come to its last days after over 40 years of marketing the project of a phantom state. This political class that has brought only shame and disaster to our people seeks today to convert the administrative autonomy in the occupied West Bank into the end of our liberation projects. The money of this class is mortgaged to the agents of the occupation, to economic peace and normalization projects. It has become imperative for our people to isolate the sector and defeat its program in the squares, streets, factories, farms, universities, and schools inside and outside occupied Palestine. And as we confront the U.S., Zionist, and reactionary policies that today target the rights of our people to life and existence, in the face of the acceleration of the hostile liquidation project that aims to demolish the horizons of the National Liberation Project and abort all possibilities for renewal, in front of the daily brutal attack on the prisoners' movement in the occupation prisons, and amid the confiscation of all of the natural and human rights of our people in the camps, silence becomes complicity, betrayal, a form of submission and failure. The time has come for these leaders of surrender to depart from the Muqaddah headquarters in Ramallah and to isolate this defeated sector that holds itself close to the Zionist entity and the CIA, participating in the collective punishment of our people in Gaza, depriving the families of martyrs and prisoners of their rights, suppressing the resistance and coordinating with the occupation forces to target the fundamentals of our society, its national resistance and its youth and student vanguard. The defeat of the Oslo Project and the isolation of Mahmoud Abbas and his cronies are more achievable and realistic than ever, despite all of the capacities and resources that the forces hostile to the Palestinian people use to support the leadership of the authority. However, the crucial element in this lengthy historical battle is the role of the popular masses and their ability to generate the revolutionary approach from the grassroots and bring it into the light, from the depths of our history and our militant legacies of struggle and from the womb of our Palestinian societies in every popular community, every neighborhood, camp, city, and village. We call on all Palestinian resistance forces, with their various political and intellectual currents and paths, to end the state of disintegration and fragmentation by forming a unified national front. This will be a support and sustenance for our people everywhere, and its sword and shield will protect our people as they continue on their historical road of great sacrifice and struggle in order to obtain their rights and break their chains, achieving our collective and complete liberation from the clutches of Zionism. We call on you to broad popular engagement and to intensify popular national activities during the week of Palestinian struggle, May 15th to 22nd, 2020, as our first stage in announcing a new phase of struggle under the slogan, Palestine Day, the Day of Return and Liberation. Let history bear witness to the crime, the ongoing Nakba that has continued since 1947 to 48 and, at the same time, testifies to the ongoing Palestinian resistance that continues until victory, despite all of the sacrifices and lengthy years of struggle. No to the path of surrender and liquidation. No to the project of the self-rule government and administrative autonomy. Yes to the path of return and liberation. Yes to the resistance and intifada until victory. Palestinian, Arab, and international organizations are invited to endorse the statement below, which will be reissued with all additional signatories. To add the signature of your group or youth organization, please email bioneouth.students@gmail.com. Signatories, last updated on May 9, 2020. Samadown Palestinian Prisoners Solidarity Network. Hirak, Palestinian Youth Mobilization, Germany. Palestinian Youth Movement, PIM. Sada Movement, Jerusalem Occupied Palestine. Al-Ada, the Palestine Right to Return Coalition / North America. Palestinian Arab Cultural Center / Rio Grande do Sul, Brazil / Union Democratica Arabo Palestinese, UDAP, Italy. Democratic Palestine Committees / Brazil. Al-Nakab Center for Youth Activities. Palestinian Chess Forum Shatila Refugee Camp. Al-Karama Palestinian Women Movement in Spain. Centro Cultural e Politico Algenia / Brazil / Brazilian Arab Palestinian Society, Corumba / Brazil. Students for Justice in Palestine at John Jay College. Students for Justice in Palestine at Butler University. General Union of Palestine Students at San Francisco State University, GUPSSFSU. Within Our Lifetime, United for Palestine. Canada-Palestine Association. Palestinian Student Association at Wilfrid Laurier University / Canada. Palestine Solidarity Collective at York University. Palestine Solidarity Group at University of Windsor.
You have been listening to the segment, The World is Talking, and as we talk about what's on the minds of the Palestinian youth and student movement. At this point in time, we're going to move forward. We're going to take a quick station break, and when we come back, we're going to discuss our topic today, the missing pages of African/Black soldiers in the U.S. Civil War, with our special guest, Mr. Ernest McBride, contributing editor of the Jackson Advocate newspaper. We'll be right back, and this is the voice of MPH Radio.
My knees alone, they play.
We'd like to welcome you back to MPH Radio. Yes, find your strength in the Creator as well as in the Almighty people who can make all things possible. You're listening to MPH Radio, which is a bi-weekly program under the banner of the Missing Pages of History, Inc., which is a nonprofit organization seeking to preserve, to create, and to develop the history of African and African people. We encourage you to come and help us build this institution. If you have an interest, you can email us at mphradio@yahoo.com. As well as you, if you would like to share your flowers with us, you can do that by using Zelle and addressing it to Missing Pages of History 1 at Yahoo, or send your donations to Missing Pages of History, Inc., P.O. Box 27782. Richmond, Virginia, 23261. We greatly thank you, and all resources will be used to continue to do the work that we need to do to conscientize our people and to make sure we have a vehicle where we can tell our story. Now, speaking about telling our story, we have a very, very special guest who is a jack of many trades, and he has mastered them all. We bring to you Brother Ernest McBride, who is the contributing editor of the Jackson Advocate. It's a newspaper based in the state of Mississippi. And he's going to speak to the theme today, the missing pages of Africans / black soldiers in the U.S. Civil War and other issues. So at this point in time, we are honored to have our brother, Brother Ernest, because we are honored to have you. We're going to bring you in, and we would like to welcome you to MPH Radio and just tell our audience a little something about who is Brother Ernest McBride. Welcome to MPH Radio.
Good afternoon, brother. I was born in Vicksburg, Mississippi in 1941. My dad was a commercial printer. He owned a print shop there in Vicksburg. I think he moved there from Mound Bayou around 1921, 26. So he had a print shop going there for a great number of years. He died in 65. I was his apprentice for about 7 years from age of, well, actually from age of four up to about age 14, 15. And I just had to give up on it because I just complained it was too much like slavery. My having to do all the work and getting paid 50 cents for a whole day's work and all. So I eventually wound up going to work as a student at the Jackson Street Colored YMCA there in Vicksburg for 2 years or so. And one of the regular guests there was Medgar Evers, who'd come in and stay overnight. But I met him before there at the YMCA before I started working there. And then after I started working there, that's where he stayed overnight when he came to Vicksburg to organize and hold the meetings in NAACP. So I got a lot of one-on-one FaceTime with him, playing dominoes, shooting basketball, and he taught me a few tricks about boxing. He was an Army boxing champion and all. And so, four or five years, I had gotten to know him. And then I went to Tougaloo College that year of the Tougaloo sit-down. Tougaloo 9, I don't know if you remember that or not, 1961, was one of those breakthroughs in Mississippi. And Medgar Evers was behind it, although the NAACP would not allow him to stage these sit-ins or even marches. That was against NAACP policy at that time. They were not street Negroes. They were courthouse Negroes. That was their motto, I guess. But Medgar took it on anyway, and so he was killed 2 years after that. I was not student body president, but I was freshman class president at Tougaloo when he staged the sit-in. I wasn't a part of the sit-in, but as a freshman class president, I urged all my classmates and the entire student body to support. We raised funds and all in support of the students. And from there, I moved to California and enrolled in LA City College. dropped out, went to the Army for 3 years, got a chance to travel to France, Turkey, Italy, and a number of other places and get to know them, learn to speak the language, especially French, and then came back to, here's a wonderful thing. I came back to California, finished my undergraduate course in journalism at Cal State Los Angeles in 1968, and then got lucky and was admitted to San Francisco State for fall of 1968. And San Francisco State was, that was the battleground of the black student movement. And I happened to be there and get in on a part of it. And let me tell you this, I can say this now because the statute of limitations have run out. There was one cop knocked out, knocked unconscious on the campus of Cal State Los Angeles, San Francisco State University, in the fall of 1968, or early 1969. And this was because Ernest McBride, a veteran of the Civil War, and a student of what they call the martial arts, had learned a few tricks, and I was able to get a cop who was on top of a young man, choking him right out in the middle of the campus, 800,000 students standing around, just, you know, calling the cop pig, but wasn't doing any good, so I got a little metal rod, stood behind the cop as he was leaning over the kid, just gave him a light tap behind the neck, and that took him out. And naturally, I left the campus immediately after that and stayed undercover for about 2 or 3 days. But that was one of those amazing experiences. And I also, if you remember the murder at UCLA in 1969, January 4th of 1969, I forget exactly. I was related to that in some way because as an undergraduate at Cal State Los Angeles, when we first started the Black Student Union there, following the model of San Francisco State, this was 2 years before I went to San Francisco State, but we would travel from campus to campus in Southern California trying to get the students to rally behind a common identity, which was the Black Student Union. And I was invited over to UCLA by a PhD candidate there who was also a professor at Cal State Los Angeles. And he asked me to speak to the Black Student Organization then known as Arambe. I don't know if you familiar with that or not, but there was a Ron Karenga influence on campus, too heavy. And so I was able to go in and persuade the students in late 68, to change their name from Cal State Los Angeles, from Harambe to the Black Student Union at UCLA. And the following year is when John Huggins and Bunchy Carter were murdered in the meeting room there. I believe the same meeting room where I had gone and persuaded the students to change the identity. And it was Ron Karenga's henchmen who killed the two Black Panthers who were students, members of the Upward Bound program at UCLA. And so that's a part of my record. And I did work in Hollywood briefly. I worked as a publicist for Universal Studios on the old shows called Banachek, McCloud, Dennis Weaver, you remember him, and Columbo, there's Peter Falk, yeah. So I was there for less than a year because that was Hollywood, white Hollywood, and here I am, a black revolutionary. We didn't get along too well. So they disinvited me from from the corporation in December 1973, yeah. And so eventually I found my way back here to Mississippi in 82 and started working with Jackson Advocate in 83. And I've had a off and on relationship there with the Jackson Advocate over the past 35 years. And so that's where I am today as a contributing editor to the Jackson Advocate.
Brother Ernest, before we
yes.
discuss our topic today dealing with African soldiers or black soldiers in the U.S. Civil War. You mentioned earlier in your introduction something about the Tougaloo 9. Give us a brief history of what was the Tougaloo 9 for those who don't know nothing about it.
All right. First, you need to go back to 1957, and you had the Little Rock. Was it Little Rock 7 or Little Rock 9? Little Rock 9, was it not? Daisy Bates. And they staged the protest to integrate the schools of Little Rock. And they had the President of the United States supporting them. Governor Faub was blocking them. Okay, so that was in 57. In 60-61, Medgar Evers had decided, it met before then, in 56, Medgar Evers had taken on the NAACP because the NAACP would not support the Montgomery boycott. And they were at the national meeting, I believe, in San Francisco in late 56. During the time of the boycott, I think it kicked off in 55, that's why, December 55. But Medgar had outed them for not supporting the boycott, and because NAACP said, we don't do that sort of thing, you know. We're not street Negroes. I believe the NAACP president, the Alabama chapter, whatever they call him, president, and Medgar Evers combined to stand up and denounce the NAACP leadership at that meeting in San Francisco. And so that was bothering him because he's looking at Martin Luther King and the students. I think SNCC was developing about that time. No, SNCC didn't develop until 61, I believe. But anyway, he was concentrating on organizing the students, and that's how he came up with the idea of the Tougaloo 9, modeled after the Little Rock 9. And the idea was to integrate the downtown library, the Carnegie Lot Library in downtown Jackson. And that's what the students did, went in and sat down at the counter, at the tables. And they were arrested briefly and threatened with, actually Tougaloo was threatened with having his charter revoked because it's a private college and the state was going to threaten to revoke their charter unless they did something about these unruly students. But that happened, and here I am. I'm kind of perplexed because I'm very much on the side of change. And the other thing that I knew about was that here was this large group of black people, let's call them Negro Americans, who didn't believe in all this civil rights mess. And I remember working at a little store, Ice House or whatever it was, owned by a white guy in my neighborhood. And every afternoon, whenever there was any kind of NAACP meeting or black meeting or anything, these two Negroes would come in. You got a bunch of white men. Oh, this was a chapter of the White Citizens Council that the store owner was the leader of. And so these two black guys around 5 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock would come in. You know how people stand around the little beer case or whatever it is, and they drink their beer and they chat. Well, they were always coming in, talking loud to each other with about 8 or 10 white men standing around. And they're talking about, y'all know what them niggas are doing down there? You know, what they talking about? They talking about integrated schools and all that. These are the two Negroes supposedly talking to themselves, but reporting to the white men. So I was aware of all this. Then beginning of 54, 55, and Emmett Till was on my mind and all that. And I would never, ever, ever betray, black people to any extent. You know, I wouldn't tolerate it. I was kind of suspicious, always wary, you know, when a situation would arise such as one at Tougaloo, because I knew a lot of those, fraternity boys and girls, sorority girls, their minds were in one place, and I doubted that they were sincerely supporting the sit-in or even the black. But it kept growing. The momentum kept growing. Dory and Joyce Latner, Dory's just in the news because she just died about a month ago, did she not? But they came to Tougaloo. They were at Jackson State, got kicked out of Jackson State the same year that I was at Tougaloo. But they came to Tougaloo in the fall of 61, and I transferred out to California in fall of 61. So I missed them until many years later when I got to know Dory pretty well from these annual conventions we'd have about the veterans of the Civil Rights Movement. But anyway, that was how the Tougaloo Nine got started. Mick Grevers had this in his mind to defy the national NAACP. Roy Bryant and what's the judge's name? Judge, what was it? Thurgood Marshall. Yeah. And the white bosses. Don't forget the white bosses of the NAACP. That's where that non-demonstration, non-street action came from. You had this Jewish, Anglo-Jewish control. They started the NAACP, and they maintained control of it, and there never was a chairman of the NAACP or national president of the NAACP until into, I think it was the middle 60s, you know. But the NAACP was always controlled by white people. And so Medgar was aware of this, and he went on stage the boycott. Another part of that is that I was at LA City College. I was having a hard time staying in school, and the draft was on my shoulders and all that, looking over my shoulders. And so I dropped out and volunteered the Army, and got my basic training in Fort Ord, California, and then they shipped me back to Augusta, Georgia, Fort Gordon. And on the way, I said I was going to go visit my mother in Vicksburg. So I got off the train in Jackson, and I said, I'm not going to go into the segregated side of the bus station. So I went into the white side of the Greyhound station, got arrested, and Meg Grevers got me out of jail, when I got to his office, he called the Justice Department, and I talked with somebody from the Justice Department. They said, did they want me to sue the city of Jackson, to take up the cause? And I said, yes, of course. You know, so the Justice Department sued the city of Jackson on my behalf. And there were two other people involved. One was Derrick Bell, you know, Derrick Bell, the lawyer who's attributed for the CRT. What's it, CRT? It's a battle critical over. Yeah, critical race theory. Derrick Bell was the second person who was there suing the city, the Justice Department suing the city on his behalf. And that was the third person, I forget. You know. But anyway, did that, got out, went back to Georgia, got shipped overseas, and then I found out that they learned that Mitt Groves was assassinated a year later. And so from that, you know, this reinforced my commitment not to get caught up in anything that even smelled of betrayal or selling out, you know, the movement or black people or anything like that. So I'm incorruptible. I mean, there are some things I indulge in that some people disagree with, but but that's life. I'm an animal. But other than that, I'm totally committed, and it's been that way here in Jackson. I've had terrible run-ins with the publishers over the years, but we'd break up and then come back together and all. And that brings us up to today. Oh, by the way, I did a lot of study while I was in California. I did a lot of study about what had happened in the South, the Civil War. I learned about the Negro in the Civil War. You know the author of that, the Negro in America. Huh?
Let's just get right into that. we talk about changing the narrative, because many times the history we have is the narrative that comes from our oppressor. So given the fact, based upon your struggles, based upon your research, can you speak a little bit about African people or black people taking the lead in a call for the so-called civil war against slavery? Can you speak on that narrative?
Yeah. The most resounding voice of 1829 was David Walker's appeal. Unfortunately, David Walker died in the same year that that his appeal came out, I believe, 1829. But Walker was a correspondent with the Freedom's Journal, which was the first black newspaper. Rushram and what's the other guy's name? They had published paper 1825, I believe it started, Freedom's Journal. And David Walker's appeal, David Walker said that any people has an absolute right to rise up and kill, if necessary, the people who would rape, kill, beat, exploit, and enslave them and their family. They had a right to do that. And so just imagine 1829, that alarm was going out all over, especially in the South, because that journal was reaching deep into Dixie. And they had a red flag set up for it that anybody caught with the copy of that would be hanged or jailed, you know. so that was the big thing, and it stimulated a lot of other people like Henry Highland Garnett, Martin Delaney, Frederick Douglass, who I believe was still enslaved at the time that the appeal came out. But there were a number of other leaders who rose up during those years. And 1843, the National Colored Convention in Buffalo, New York, took place. And Henry Highland Garnett was, I think, the most resounding voice. And he called for organizing militias, black militias, and preparing, training for battle. He and Martin Delaney, I believe, called for the black people who were enslaved in the South to rise up against their masters. Frederick Douglass, who attended that meeting in 1843, cautioned against that because he said, they're just going to get in trouble. Masters are going to beat them and, you know, make it worse for them. But one of the items that they decided on, Highland Garnett and Delaney, it was a newspaper. They said they needed a newspaper, a special newspaper. So Martin Delaney developed The Mystery. That's what it was called in 1843, the same year, and continued to call for the battle against slavery. He kept that going until 1846, I believe, 45, 46. And then Martin Delaney started writing for Frederick Douglass, who started the North Star in 1847. And so that became the main communication tool for against slavery. Although it was kind of lukewarm, it was not, in fact, it was less radical than Garrison's paper, you know. Garrison called for an all-out war against the United States Constitution and everything. Douglass said, "No, we got to keep God in the in the picture too. You know, we can't just overturn everything." And so that's where that's some of the early writings. The Mystery by Martin Delaney, and then the Frederick Douglass's North Star. Both of them, I think, derived from the National Colored Convention in 1843. And that National Colored Convention, I believe, was inspired mainly by David Walker's appeal of 1829. And I think, should I continue from there or just leave that?
I was asked a question. You can continue while I can raise the question as relates to this time period. Was there a common link between John Brown and Ulysses Grant before the Civil War?
Yeah, there definitely there were several links. I was thinking that both the grandfathers were in the Revolutionary War, but Grant's great-grandfather, his name was Harrison Terrell, I believe. His great-grandfather, his name was Noah Grant, I'm sorry. He had fought in the French and Indian Wars with two black men. One was named Prince and the other was named Jupiter. I'm getting this from Ron Chernow's 2017 biography of Grant. It's a good book, great reading. Grant's great-grandfather in the French and Indian War with free black men, Prince, and Prince. Oh, and Jupiter, that was his name. And then Grant's father, Jesse Grant, worked for John Brown's father in what do they have? People who work with metal, fixing these links and things for horses and ironworks and stuff like that. That's Grant's father worked for John Brown's father, who owned the shop back then. So here's these convergent, experiences bringing these people together before the Civil War. So you can understand why some of these guys were on the same wavelength and on the same side when it came to the Civil War. It wasn't like they woke up one day and there, boom, they were suddenly, in the middle of the Civil War and decided that, okay, I'll fight for the North and as opposed to someone else. Another fact about John Brown was that the National Colored Convention people were recruiting him also, because he had this battle over in Kansas and they were very close to him and they supported him. But they saw John Brown not as the military leader, but as the as another captain, because they had a number of black men and women. Harriet Tubman was considered to be a general herself, but John Brown was not this this singular white man, jumping in front of a proposed 200,000 man black army, of liberated slaves. He was one of many proposed captains in the crusade, and so. There's that link between John Brown and Grant. Serendipity, I think it is, that we have the people come together like that. Civil War, beginning in April of 1861, what prevented black men from being recruited early on, since they were anxious to get in there and go to war against slavery, and they had fought in the Revolutionary War and French and Indian War. What's keeping them from being from joining in on the Civil War after April 61? In 1792, the white boys who ran the U.S. government decided that they didn't want black men armed or prepared to do war against the disorder, which was white supremacy and all. So they passed the Second Militia Act in 1792 that allowed only white males in the military, except for the Navy that used black guys in the galleries to clean the dishes, prepare the food and stuff like this. But you had just two branches of the military service, an Army and Navy. Army barred black men after 1792. And so that law was in place all the way up until 1862, when the Second Confiscation Act was passed. And so that answers the question, why wouldn't Lincoln draft black men into the Army? It's because he couldn't, because of the law. Yeah, and so that law was overcome in 1862, and And in August of 1862, after the Battle of Antietam, remember, Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation in August 1862. But guess what? It wouldn't go into effect until January of 1863. And so there, you know, there was a lot of rumbling and grumbling. But even then, between August 1862 and January 1863, there were a number of black regiments that were formed and some black action. I think in October of 1862, the first battle engagement between First Kansas colored troops, and some of the Confederate forces he had organized in Missouri. They were challenged by the First Kansas Colored. This is before they were officially brought into the U.S. Army. First Kansas Colored fought the Confederates in October 62. And there wasn't, I don't know who won the battle. I don't even know there was a real serious engagement. I think several people were killed, but there was no victory declared on that occasion. And then in Ship Island down in the Gulf of Mexico, just off course of the coast of Mississippi and Louisiana, Ship Island, Black Regiment, I think it was the first or second Native Guard, Louisiana Native Guard, that was sent down to guard some Confederate prisoners that had been captured in the Battle of New Orleans or Battle of Mobile. So this was before the official recruitment of black troops into the United States Army. And you had some organizations over in South Carolina, forget the general's name or colonel, who had organized a troop, a regiment, First South Carolina. And they were just put on hold until the Emancipation Proclamation or the recruitment actually went into effect. So all this was happening before the official recruitment of black troops was allowed. And you might want to know something about the Louisiana Native Guard. Louisiana Native Guard, roughly around 1729, when the Natchez Indian, along with their black allies, rose up against the French in Natchez, the area in their territory, the Natchez Indians and all. And you had, if I remember, there was a black African leader, I don't know his name was, no, it wasn't Zumbi. I forget his name right now, but he was one of the main leaders. And the French put a price on his head, and he was captured and killed. But this is 1729. And a number of the free people of color, les gens de couleur, that's what they were called in French, were brought into the French army as, you know, troops to suppress the Natchez Indians and the black Africans who were fighting alongside the Natchez Indians. And so these black men of color, gens de couleur, were allowed to form their own companies and regiments and they stayed together from 1729, 1740, and they were still together as late as 1861 when the Civil War broke out, and the call went out for volunteers in Louisiana, New Orleans especially. And 2,000 black men stepped up to join the state militia or the army that was being formed in Louisiana on the side of the Confederacy, and they became known as the first. What were we talking about? We were talking about the local guard, the Native Guard, the 1st Regiment of the Native Guard, and they had their own officers. But although the locals, the New Orleans area wanted these troops, the national government said, no, we don't want any Negroes armed. So they were disbanded. And then 1862, I think General Butler came through New Orleans, and he reorganized the Louisiana Native Guard, and they were organized into three regiments, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, initially. And so this is the group that became associated with the Siege of Vicksburg, and also the Battle of the lookout overlooking down in Louisiana. I forget right now, but I'll remember it later. But they became part of the U.S. Army in late 1862 after Butler came through. Remember now that all this was happening before Lincoln gave his own adjutant general the order to go and formulate 10 black regiments. This was in February, March 1863. General Lorenzo Thomas, it was the adjutant general at the time, and so he gave him the go-ahead, and General Thomas went into Arkansas at first, and he started recruiting black soldiers, formed 4 regiments initially, and then gave the order, passed the order on down to Louisiana, and they formed the 9th and 11th black regiments, or colored regiments. No, they call them African descent. It was always put in the parentheses. They were known as the African Brigade, this first 10 regiments, beginning February, March 1863, all the way up to May of 1863. When they became official United States colored troops, and that's what they were known as all for the rest of the Civil War. But so you've got a picture of, you've got the side action that was not under the control, directly under control of the president. A lot of it by default and by action that was beyond his control. But when he gave the order to General Lorenzo Thomas, go down, organize him, and that they organized the Bureau of Colored Troops. That's what they were called, the first big test for these newly organized, the African Brigade, was at Milliken's Bend. It was June 7th, 1863. Let me fill you in on something. Grant had declared in 1892, this November 1892, and Lincoln too said Vicksburg is the key to the winning of the Civil War. Vicksburg, Mississippi, overlooking the Mississippi River. Mississippi was the second most prosperous state in the Union, total, before the Civil War. And Vicksburg was the most prosperous city. And they didn't want a part, really didn't want a part of the Civil War. They, in fact, when they polled the people there, they voted to stay out of the Civil War. But Jefferson Davis was from Mississippi, just below Vicksburg. And so naturally, if you're going to make your commanding general the head of your military, he's got to be able to bring his hometown, his home state in. So that's what happened. Naming Jefferson Davis president of the Confederacy made sure that Vicksburg and the wealthiest state in the South became a part of the Confederate cause. All right. And so that was 1861, late 1861, What was it? It was April 12th, April 15th, 1861, that South Carolina fired the first shot against the United States, took over Fort Sumter, and that was the beginning of the Civil War. And late into December and January, I think Jefferson Davis was named president of the Confederacy in January 61. And meanwhile, oh, the question is, were there any black soldiers fighting on the side of Confederacy? There were a lot of black men who were brought into the Confederacy as servants of their masters, who were generals and colonels and all. And sometimes the corvée labor, but the owners of the slaves said, no, you can't just confiscate our property like that. These are, you know, this is my property. You go, you want to use my property, you got to pay for it. So they could not just grab black men and force them to do the army work, you know, dig the holes, the ditches, and all this. Aside from the first Louisiana Native Guard, which was became three Native Guard units under the United States, that first Native Guard group started out at 2,000. I think something like 75% of that group, 72,000, were brought into the Louisiana Native Guard under the Confederacy, but they did not fight. They never got a chance to fight anybody. I think that they were used to bring the dead back from, they called it Bull Run here in the South. What's the name of the first battle where the South defeated the United States? The first battle of Bull Run. I know that stuff, and yet I lose the name of
the. Don't worry about it. We got the picture. We got the picture. Continue to share.
You got the picture that went there. What?
No, I said we got the point where you can mention the first battle, the first union. That I was saying, just continue to tell your story.
First battle of Bull Run from the Confederate side. So they used the Louisiana Native Guard, the volunteers, to fight on the side of Confederacy. They were not allowed to fight, but they did use them to retrieve the bodies, Confederate dead, from Bull Run, wherever it was. And then at the very end of the Civil War, in March of 1865, when Jefferson Davis was on the run, getting out of Richmond, your town, and it was lost because Robert E. Lee surrendered on April 9th, April 10th, and so during that last month, they recruited a company or two of black volunteers, I think it was, to serve as regimental guards at Richmond, to defend the capital, and they were just posted there. They never engaged in battle. So those were the only two actual examples of black soldiers having any kind of a legitimate status in the Civil War on the Confederate side. All this other stuff about thousands of black men volunteering to fight for the South, no, that's a bunch of bunk. It never happened. Never happened. In fact, when there was a general, he was an Irish native who became a general, joined the Confederates in Arkansas, and he had the idea that, hey, these Northerners have all come down here. They're recruiting our black soldiers, our black slaves, and making soldiers out of them to fight against us. We ought to be able to do the same thing, but we're going to have to promise them their freedom. We can't just get slaves, force them to fight, and then throw them back into slavery. And so this proposal was sent up to Jefferson Davis, commanding general of the Confederate forces. He rejected it outright and said, tear up any copy of this this suggestion or proposal. On your life, if we find another copy of this anywhere, that person, general, common soldier, whatever, will be immediately executed. No, we will not tolerate any talk about using Negro, black slaves in the Confederate military. So that was March, April, 1864. All right? So meanwhile, getting back to the Milliken's Bend, this was the first action where there was clear-cut victory on the part of the earliest recruits from the United States African descent colored troops fighting to defend the old headquarters of General Grant. Grant had begun his siege of Vicksburg, which was the key to the victory. And Lincoln said, I want you to put that key in my pocket, which Grant set up this elaborate system of surrounding Vicksburg, going all the way around it. They're on the west bank of the Mississippi looking at Vicksburg, which they could not approach it. The city itself sat about a quarter mile above the river. And then on the north side, you had all these bramble bushes and thickets you could not get through. And on the south side, you had a number of Confederate forces there. But the Mississippi itself, below Vicksburg, around Port Gibson and these other key points there that were battle sites, they were also nearly impregnable, but Grant found a way to get downstream down to a crossing point. I forget what it was. But meanwhile, they left four regiments, three black regiments, the 1st Mississippi, the 9th Louisiana, and the 11th Louisiana. They should all be called the African descent. And then you have one white regiment among them, the Iowa 23rd. And it was 410 of these troops that were left behind to guard the old headquarters at Milliken's Bend. Basically, to say they had Grant's back, all right? But then the seasoned Confederate soldiers sneaked in on them early in the morning, 2:30 in the morning, on June 3rd. I think there were 3,000, 4,000 against 410. And they were sweeping them back through the bramble bushes and all, and almost had swept them back into the river. And then that's when Admiral Porter lobbed a number of shells from the river onto the embankment. He killed some of his own men, but he stopped the Confederates. So they pushed back, and Grant sent one of his regiments from over on the east side of Vicksburg, sent them back over across the river to help protect that area around Milliken's Bend. But the troops, black troops, performed remarkably, and they got a big write-up in the New York Times and other publications. And Lincoln was delirious with joy. And Grant himself said, this was the first time that the black troops had been brought into combat, and they performed extremely well. So he was complimenting them himself. And this was his headquarters, essentially, that they were protecting. But, of course, his army was mobile. And so his headquarters was essentially wherever he was. But that had been his headquarters. And he stated so in his memoirs. All right. So Battle of 1860, June 7, 1863. Now, I did an article just recently about Ross's Landing, which happened about a year after Milliken's Bend. Ross Landing was a place about 12, 15 miles north of Milliken's Bend. We're in Louisiana now. Remember, on the west side of the Mississippi. And they fought. Okay, the Siege of Vicksburg is over because Grant won that July 4th, 1863, Vicksburg surrendered. But he still had these troops deployed on the west side of Mississippi, and they had orders to go and forage for supplies, for livestock, and food. And so the 1st Mississippi, a 20-man entourage from the 1st Mississippi was sent up to do the foraging. And they were attacked, surprise attacked, by a large Confederate group. And most of them were killed. And but their bodies were brought back eventually to the Milliken's Bend area. And they were just recently found and reburied in the Vicksburg National Cemetery, which is another interesting thing. The Vicksburg National Cemetery is the largest containment for Civil War dead, black or white. 17,500 are buried there. 42% of that group are black soldiers. And what is significant about that is that the order that created the national cemeteries, issued in 1866, required that the bodies at each of the national cemeteries should be brought in from within a 60-mile radius, either 60-mile or 66-mile radius of the cemetery. So if you've got really 7,240 out of 17,500 black soldiers buried, the largest number of black soldiers buried anywhere on the planet that had any kind of affiliation with the United States military, buried there at Vicksburg. And one of the best kept secrets from black people for over 100 years. They wouldn't let black people know that here are these black heroes who are buried here in your hometown of Vicksburg, Mississippi. Yeah, at the National Cemetery. And so growing up in Vicksburg myself, I never heard of it. It's only after I got to reading Benjamin Quarles, The Negro in the Civil War, and that opened my eyes about the Battle of Milliken's Bend and subsequent events, and such as the burial sites at Vicksburg and all.
Okay, Brother Ernest, what we're going to do, we're going to take a station break. When we come back,
okay,
we will continue discussion. We open up our phone lines for our listening audience. You may like to have questions or comments about this area
okay
that we're discussing as relates to Africans, black soldiers, and the U.S. Civil War. We'll be right back.
Okay.
This is MPH Radio.
Very good.
Tennessee. Lord, I've really been real stressed, down and out, losing ground. Although I am black and brown, problems got me pessimistic. Brothers and sisters keep messing up. Why does it have to be so damn tough? I don't know where I can go to let these ghosts out of my skull. My grandma passed, my brother's gone. I never at once felt so alone. I know you're supposed to be my steering wheel, not just my spare tire. The Lord, I ask you to be my guiding force and truth. For some strange reason it had to be. He guided me to Tennessee. Tell me to break. out of the country and into more country. Fast eyes burst into Richmond, where the ghosts of childhood haunt me. Walk the road my forefathers walked, climb the trees my forefathers hung from. Ask those trees for all their wisdom. They tell me my ears are so young. Go back to whence you came, my family tree, my family name. For some strange reason it had to be, he guided me to Tennessee.
Down to Holly Springs. Razadon and Baba, they went down to Peace Street. Headliner, I challenge you to a game of horseshoes. A game of horseshoes!
Now I see the importance of history. While my people be in the mess that they be. Many journeys to freedom made in vain by brothers on the corner playing ghetto games. I ask you, Lord, why you enlighten me without the enlightenment of all my folks. You said, cause I set myself on a quest for truth and you was there to quench my thirst. But I am still thirsty. Lord, allow me to drink some more. He said, what I am searching for are the answers to all which are in front of me. The ultimate truth started to get blurry. For some strange reason, it had to be. It was all a dream about Tennessee.
We'd like to welcome you back to MPH Radio. We were Brother Ernest McBride, who's a contributor editor of the Jackson Advocate in the state of Mississippi, and we're discussing the history and the conditions of Africans/Black soldiers during the U.S. Civil War. At this particular time, for our listening audience, if you'd like to weigh in and have a question or comment that you would like to raise for Brother Ernest, you can do this by dialing 818-337-0016. Please hit one now for those who are on my board, and I will acknowledge your last four numbers. Brother Ernest, let's take a few questions right now. And we have these listeners who've been waiting very patiently, so we're going to bring in Carlos 6029. Welcome to MPH Radio. Your question or comment, 6029.
Yes, sir. Thanks for having me. Listen, I just want to thank the brother for his presentation. You know, it was very, very enlightening. But I do have some philosophical questions. And the first question is this. One of the things historically, when we talk about during the era of Civil War in a society, there was this perception among many white folks, particularly the elites, that African people would not fight, nor they have the will nor the desire to fight. And I find that extraordinary, given the fact that when you talk about a people who are oppressed, who have to endure the daily indignities in terms of, you know, being oppressed, or if they get the opportunity to fight, it seems to me that they'd be more than willing to fight. So what is your view in terms of why, despite the very horrible conditions that African people were consigned to, that white people will actually believe that Africans somehow lack the ability to fight? What is your perception in terms of these white folks' views?
White supremacy. You can go back to the early days, let's say the 1900s, 1890s, 1900s, in the world of boxing. You never had any black contenders for any of the championships. You know, it was a white man's thing, and the presumption was that black men could not fight. You know, that they, you know, only white men were capable of entering that masculine art of self-defense or whatever it was. No, they did that. It's a rationale. It's the same that these Israelis are doing against the Palestinians now, and they have been lying, saying the Palestinians are just a bunch of grub, you know, sucking do-nothings, and they can't fight. They're scared to fight and all that. And but the same lie was perpetrated against black people, although black people in many cases kick these white people's butts, beginning as early as 1516 in Panama. You know, they escaped this, set up their own colony there, and they would kick the shit out of them. And I think it was Francis Drake who came through there and recruited, struck up an alliance with these black, the African tribes in Panama who were independent, and use them against the Spaniards to overthrow the Spanish Empire in America. And look, these guys knew that, but it was a matter of numbers and advantage. As long as they had the weapons, as long as they had the police controls and the enslavement and jailhouses and all, they were, you know, they were superior to black people. What black man is going to fight against 20 white men with rifles, you know? You know, some tried, but they all died, you know. So that was it. And so they passed that law in 1792. They knew that that black men were fighting, many of them, for the British. And they won their freedom from the British, and they escaped. They were transported to England. But, you know, they knew that. So, but they passed this law. They convinced themselves that these Negroes are not going to fight. And as long as you can keep people in slavery, you know, that's what that's the condition they were looking at. And so when the war broke out, got started, 18, and they were bringing in black troops officially, everybody was, all the black commanders were standing around with bated breath, wondering, will these guys be able to do anything? Are they going to prove themselves? And that's what Milliken's Bend essentially was all about. Charles Dana, he's a famous newspaper man, newspaper editor also. He was Lincoln's intelligence officer sent down to Milliken's Bend to observe the battle there. And it was his report that sent word back to the press all over the country that these black men will fight. So June 7, 1863, that's when the black men in battle had to prove themselves that they were. Oh, may I point out one other thing at about this this one great black hero? His name was John, they call him Big Jack Jackson. He was the one who did the actual recruiting of the black troops, first Mississippi especially, because, you know, when the war first broke out, black men and women were leaving these plantations, especially Mississippi, Louisiana, elsewhere, and they were flooding into the campsites of the Union soldiers. The Union soldiers were beating them and pushing them out, saying, no, you can't come in here, you go back where you came from. And so the people were pissed off. Here we are leaving slavery, and these white men from the north are pushing us right back into slavery. And so there was reluctance after that, especially on the part of black women, to allow their men or their boys to go into the U.S. Army because they remembered the treatment they had gotten during those months between April 1861 and November 1862, when the war was raging on, but they were not recognized as self-liberated people. I mean, it was General Butler, remember, back up in Maryland. He was the first one who came up with the idea that these people are contraband of war. It's just like anything else. that the South need these black people to keep their economy, their war machine going. Take that war machine, that advantage away from them, and they're going to break down. So this is a contraband of war. And so that pin, that official label that let black people into your encampments. And so General Lorenzo Thomas had that order. And he told these white commanders, local commanders, that if you don't let these black people into your camps and all, you will come up for court-martial. So this is 1863 when that was happening. But up until that point, it was can black men fight? They knew they could, but the thing about it, they put the shackles on them, handcuffed them, and told them we're talking about that act of 1792 that said no black man would be allowed in the military except as a galley slave or whatever. You know, so that's what it was about. And tell that lie long enough, and black men and women are going to believe the same thing. They're going to believe that about themselves. No, who can imagine themselves in the middle of a war if there are no examples? You know, but Big Jack Jackson, as I said, he had come into the picture. He had come out of the West somewhere, and joined up with the United States Army and became recruiting sergeant, and the white guys went into that area after the U.S. Army is saying, okay, black people, come on in, we need your men to fight for us. The white recruiters went into the areas around Vicksburg and all, and the women chased them out and said, no, get out of here, we don't want anything to do with it. And what happened was that they got Jackson sergeant to go into these same areas. And he told these women and their men that this is your war. This is going to liberate you, just like me. He was in his splendid uniform. Just like me, you will be an agent of your own liberation. You know? And so on the night of June 7, 1863, Jack Jackson, leading the 1st Mississippi Regiment, was killed. He was out front leading his men into battle, and so he's one of those heroes that we know too little about. You can find this in I think it's Trudeau's book called Like Men of War. Like Men of War. I think he wrote that in 2012. It's a good book, good encapsulation of the overall Civil War, but this one exemplary man of action, you know, is really inspiring. I hope that answers the question for you.
Yeah, it does. And one last question, brother. You know, one of the things is that, you know, and you alluded to this, is that you talk about, you know, all these battles, African people have emerged successful in terms of defeating, their counterpart, the conservative South. And what is interesting is that when you think about in terms of will, this desire to fight, in addition to this aspect of organization, African people proved to be formidable. And one thing I find interesting is that when you stop and think about it, let me just pose this question to you. When you look at it in terms of Christopher Princeton, in terms of, you know, fighting and organization combined, making a formidable community, do you think in today's world, when white historians or white people generally look back at the military prowess of African people, that it's a source of concern in today's America?
Is there what? A social concern in today's America? I didn't quite understand.
Source of concern.
But looking back at black people's history, their confrontation of the system and defeating the white supremacy in a number of cases. Are they concerned about that?
Precisely. I mean, these are concrete examples in terms of African people's ability to wage war and depend on the wage war to be successful. So it would be very, very disconcerting for white folks to acknowledge. And in fact, it's what principally exists among African people. In that regard, when you think about policy as it exists today, a lot of it is geared toward not only diminishing African people contribution, you know, for example, the Civil War, but more importantly, to diminish African people ability to, one, discern what's going on, to actually fight, but in fighting, realizing that organization is the key in terms of winning. So I'm just asking you, maybe make some type of analysis in terms of, you know, historically, you know, African people's willingness to fight and being successful, and what potential conflicts does that place in the minds of white people today when they look back on the history of African people?
Okay. I'm not in the head of white people, but I do know something about long-term memory, deep memory, and short-term memory. Most of the white societies, Western societies, Western Europe, England, and the United States, and a lot of white-dominated Latin America, they have these short-term memories. They can only see from their lifetime up to the present, or if there had been some kind of resistance, that resistance like the Turner Rebellion, Vincent, some of the other rebellions and all, they were usually stemmed pretty early on. And so they were victorious in fending off whatever black challenge there was to the white status quo, white domination. So they that there's no deep-seated fear. They cannot go back to the era of the black Africans sweeping into Spain, conquering the Goths, who were the Germanic people who were dominating Spain at the time. But they, these black men and women, black men especially, swept through the Spanish peninsula and conquered it and stayed there for 900 years. That's not a part of the deep memory of the white men of today, because they go back through another reality, which was the Anglo-Saxons fighting against the Romans and eventually supplanting the Romans and becoming the dominant forces themselves. They are the ones who are to be feared. They did not have that experience of being dominated by the Moors for 800-900 years. If they had, then they would have, that fear would still be in their conscience, deep-seated conscience. So, no, their experience has been that they were able to snuff out whatever black threats there were throughout the duration, they say 400-500 years, that they have been dominant in the Americas, yeah. That's my stand on it. That no, it's not there. The fear is not there, as it would be, say, among the Spaniards. I think the Spanish people have this knowledge and awareness of it, because in a lot of cases they recruit black men. They recruit black men in their battles against other white people. Yeah, even today. Yeah.
All right, thank you, caller. Yeah, let's move on to our next caller.
Mm-hmm.
You have a comment, caller? Okay, let's move on to our next caller. Caller, we'll bring in 6057. Caller 6057, the mic is yours. 6057, welcome to MPH Radio.
Thank you for having me. I found the narrative your guest gave very interesting. I want to comment briefly that Europeans throughout the world are trying to deny the role that Africans played in terms of ending chattel slavery in the U.S. And this is unfortunate because it has an influence on our youth, especially since we don't we're not organized enough to control the education of our youth as we should. I was I just wanted to comment that a lot of Europeans are still advocates of white supremacy, even in spite of our efforts to fight against it.
Yeah, I agree, and the reason for that is because, as I pointed out in my discussion, when I was growing up, we had this developing resistance or desire to overthrow the white absolute rule over black people. Their destiny, their lives, their economy, their relationships and all. But there were a number of black people. In fact, I would say the majority of black people who didn't want to touch that thing, didn't want to change that thing, who would go to the white people and say, hey, yo, them niggas down there trying to, talking about integrating the schools and all, you know. So, yeah, that has been... That never went away, even at the you might say the high tide of the transformation. There, I don't think it was ever a revolution except back during the Restriction era. That definitely was a revolution. It was not a permanent revolution, but it was a revolution. But what has happened since the time of Jim Crow? Jim Crow has never gone away. It's always been lying dormant, if not dormant. They've had their own little secret cabals and things where they kept the feeling alive, like the Committee of Conservative Citizens, which still exists in Mississippi today. That's a former White Citizens Council. And people like the former Governor Haley Barbour, the current governor, pitiful son of a gun that he is, Tate Reeves, they all court this this group called the Committee of Conservative Citizens, and they never went away. The White Citizens Council never went away. The Klan never went away, but they just they were pushed to the background, and they accepted their role because the dominant narrative said that we were moving on, that the nation was moving on, that civil rights was moving on, that black people were taking offices of the presidency and secretary of state, et cetera. So you had to tolerate it because they were in a minority, especially a vocal minority. But they bided their time, and they've come back. And what do you have now? You got Tate Reeves, the current governor of Mississippi, to me is a throwback to Ross Barnett. Idiot Donald Trump. He's just a throwback to everything bad. You know, the man doesn't have a mind. He's just he's just a conglomeration of idiocies and hate-filled spiels that he comes out just keeps everybody agitated. Everything from the past that has lain dormant is there, and it can get worse, you know. So the kids growing up in these households, you know, they learn that stuff from parents. But then again, there are some parents who taught the kids exceedingly well, gotten them to break away from the old dominant patterns of hatred and white supremacy. Yeah, that's possible, but it was never the guaranteed ticket, you know, if you understand what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I do. And let's see, could you address the importance of our people getting organized, better organized than they are, instead of our dependency upon let's see, some a sect of us are seem to be totally dependent upon the Democratic Republican duopoly. And I was wondering if you could, address that.
Okay, let me say this, that I went to graduate school and especially learn about organization development and structure and organization of, I mean, structure and development of organizations. And so this was at the graduate school at the University of Southern California. That, along with advanced courses in marketing and all, how to get ideas across, and so that was in 70, 71. All right, here we are in 2024.
Yes.
Yeah. What is this? That's 40, 50 years later.
Yeah.
And at this stage of my life, I'm more pessimistic about. Depending on expecting favorable outcomes to any system of organization or any approach to organization today. I don't see it happening. I'm disappointed in most of the organizations I see going around. And there are some pretty solid organizations developing. To me, they are retrogressive. They have a negative they leave a negative impression in my mind because I don't see the good or positive coming out of it. For some people, yeah, sure. Some people do benefit, make a lot of money. You got more billionaires in the world today, and especially in the United States, than you ever had before. So somebody's benefiting from the current order of things. But, no, I'm pessimistic. I have very few friends. Black friends here in Mississippi. I'm talking about real friends that I sit and talk with or, you know, even work out any kind of strategy, planning, anything. They're just not there. I don't associate. I don't have these associates. So I'm not a good person to use as a reference about the benefits of organization in today's society, especially in the United States. I think it'll lead to more negative consequences than to positive, because I think you got mostly charlatans and people who only care about themselves or their own immediate associates rather than about the good of the society or any common good, as it used to be called. And that's where I am. No, I don't expect any really great benefits coming out of anything. Look at your presidency, campaign for the presidency. Who would vote for any of this junk? You know? I mean, really, what sane person would vote for any of this junk that's being offered? Not even the Kennedy. Kennedy's out of his mind. The Trump is something that needs to be flushed down the toilet and forgotten. And Joe Biden, probably one of the biggest traitors to the cause of humanity that ever held that office, you know? So I don't see anything happening. Cornel West, no, he's not. There's no promise in him either. He talks a halfway good game, but I don't think he'd help us, even if we were able to organize around his program and all. So here we are just on the threshold of that vast emptiness. How are we going to meet that challenge in the future? I don't know.
so you're saying that we continue to fall in the trap of these two-party systems, thinking they're going to deliver us what we need, which is our liberation and freedom.
Well, if you want to think in human terms, in terms of the organism, human being, there's no two-party thing that that is inherent in the human biogeny, you might say. That's something else, the social constructs that were pretty much imposed on us, you know. Mm-hmm. And we're here, and we lived for, since about 180,000 years, out of the 180,000 years, I think 170,000 of them were done without, one tribe imposing itself on another tribe. But we're going back about 20,000 years. Although, you know, there was this fundamental conflict there. But two-party system and all that, no, that's not a fundamental part of our nature. And what we need to be doing is looking at our fundamental nature and all, and trying to deal with it from that standpoint. That's my view of it. But I can't say I totally wash my hands of the system, because there are some issues that I still vote on. But to embrace Biden in order to oppose Trump is a never, ever, never piece of nothing or piece of negativity as far as I'm concerned. But because he is that opprobrious, disgusting, you know, piece of slob, I'm not going to go turn around and go embrace this guy who has no appreciation of people who are set at a disadvantage, people who lie to the world, people who have murdered, committed genocide in front of our own eyes. And not only that, but he accepted every lie that they told and just spewed it from the highest office in the land. No, I have no respect for him. I have to say I have a little more respect for him than for the opposition, Donald Trump. But no, simply because you left with that two-handed, factor that you really, both outcomes are equally disagreeable, disgusting. So I don't know. And as I said, whatever's happening is going to go on for some time, and much of it is going to lie reticent, in the background. But it's going to be there to haunt us, to continue to haunt us, no matter how far along we go, until a real, genuine revolution in human thought and action takes place.
Okay, Brother Ernest, let's go to our next caller. Let's go to our next caller.
Right.
Caller, your last four numbers are 4298. 4298, welcome to MPH Radio.
Thank you, Brother Robinson. My name is Robert Andrew Moses. I'm thankful for the brother elaborating on the struggle of African American, Afro American people in the struggle for dignity and civil rights. I'm reading a book, Shocking the Conscience, a reported account of the civil rights movement by Simeon Booker, who was with Jet Magazine and Ebony Magazine as a reporter during all those years. And Mississippi was the bastion, is the bastion of reaction. I mean, we have white minority rule there where the majority of people are black and the
majority is white. Majority is white. 42% mm-hmm. black. Minority here, 52-54% white majority.
Oh, they changed since, I think things have changed since I was reading about it. And I guess he was reporting in.
It's been that way since about 19 or somewhere in the 50s, from the 40s to the 50s. You had that that white resurgence, and black people were actually being chased out of Mississippi too.
Right.
So
right.
There was a black majority here, but they've long since gone.
But the point is, the white people are trying to keep black people off the polling rolls, off the voting rolls, because they can maintain their power, they can maintain their control of the political economy that way. And you know, to talk about organization and not talk about voting rights and the power of the vote is to just be talking. We have to get organized in a united front against these fascists who are a very real threat. And Donald Trump is like Hitler, we have to recognize it for what it is and have no illusions about it. It's a very, very dangerous times right now. And we have to have a united front of the Democratic-minded and the socialist-minded and the communist-minded against this fascist and a tit-for-tat struggle on every level, economically, theoretically, and politically. And we shouldn't have any illusions about that.
Let me respond to that, especially since you brought up the topic of illusions. Mississippi, a majority white state, they have absolute majorities in both the House of Representatives and the state Senate. They hold down all the top 8 elective offices in the state. In the Senate, I think you have 12 out of 52 senators. You got 14 black Democrats, or 14 Democrats, period. And in the House, you have 36, 38 black Democrats versus out of 120, 122, I believe it is, yeah. House of Representatives. But let me tell you something about the makeup of the black minority. In the Senate, I'd say you have 4 or 5 black senior running dogs of white supremacy. I mean, they're out to get whatever they can from the system. And they've been selling out for the past 20, 30 years. Not necessarily the same ones, but these guys and the ones they replaced were pretty much, a part of that, that sellout system in the House of Representatives. The guy who's the chief spokesman for the Democrats in the House of Representatives today, back in 2011, when the Democrats had what they called an absolute majority in the House, this guy was bargaining with the white supremacists to destroy that black-white Democratic majority coalition. And so that guy from back then, Democrat, selling out to get what he said. The white guy had promised to give him the Speaker pro tem position. You know, that was going to be his reward. But here he is today. He is a spokesperson for the minority party in the House of Representatives. How can that be? How can a guy who's selling out the black people or the Democratic Party in 2011, how can he be the representative voice for those Democrats today? That is the reality. And he has about, I don't know how many other out of the 30 black Democrats in the House of Representatives. I don't know exactly how many are, of the same kind, because I separated myself from the state legislature. I used to be there for every day of the deliberations. They only meet for 3 or 4 months out of the year. So I used to, from 88 all the way up to 2018, I think it was, I was there for just about every session. But after that, I found that some of the once the Republicans took over, they knew that they would look bad if they fired all the black office management and employees that had come to the top under the Democrats. So they kept these, black guys and women in place. So they were like the voice, on the floor, announcing the deliberations. You had a black voice, and one of these guys decided that he was going to enter collusion with the, what do they call the Senate president, white Senate president, who for some reason decided that he didn't want me be walking behind the enclosure, or walking out on the floor as I had the privilege to do, as as a properly credentialed a reporter. And so he told the guy, the black guy who's in charge of issuing credentials, put me on restriction. So that's what the guy did. In fact, when I went up to get my credentials, he had them laid out, and then I picked it up. I said, okay, I got it. Regular credentials. He jumped up out of his seat and ran over and snatched it out of my hand and said, no, you got the wrong ones. Come back in a day or two. I'll have your credentials. Went back, and it was restricted credentials. It restricted me to the gallery, just like it restricted the public to the gallery. I could take all the pictures I wanted, sit up there all day if I wanted to, but I could not come down on the floor, could not engage in conversation with the various legislators and all, like the white reporters were still able to do. And this was a black man who did that to me in 2018, so I just said, I'm through with these people. I in effect, staged my own boycott against of them. Didn't go anywhere. Except it gave me the satisfaction of knowing that I stuck it to them. They didn't stick it to me. I mean, they did stick it to me, but I stuck it to them. I gave them the finger. And the guy, I see him, he wants to be all innocent even now that I'm going back into the chamber on occasion. He wants to know whether I still hold this grudge against him. It's not a grudge. This is a state of existence. You're on that side, I'm over on this side. There's no grudge that I'm holding against you. I just know who you are. And that's basically what I'm trying to point out is simply because you have Democratic labels, you have black faces, etc., it's dangerous to rely on those appearances. You've got to have people with heart and dedication go along with that face or the appearances. Are you
okay,
there?
Okay, Brother Ernest, let's take this next caller. We're going to bring my co-host, Brother Alex. Brother Alex, welcome to the program again. And any of your comments, any engagements you'd like to make with Brother Ernest on our subject today. The mic is yours, Brother Alex.
Yes, Mr. McBride, and thank you, Brother Lee, for bringing him forward today, because he's given us unlimited information here that we need to take to heart, because he lived through a time and still with us. That's the most important thing, that not only did he live through the time, but he is still here to give us knowledge of what he went through. And he became my friend at the first moment of mentioning Meg Evans. So, that's 10 feathers in his cap right now. But again, he's mentioned some important things that said about what I talked about last week, 2 weeks ago. And that was the self-hatred of our own race. And what I'm talking about, it started back well before the Civil War, but that separation of our people and giving some rights and some no rights, as the Willie Lynch letter reported, how to separate us and keep us separated and not talking like we talking today. So came the Civil War, and you had the House Negroes that did not want to leave the master, told everything that the Field Negroes was planning, and wanted those Field Negroes back on the plantation, even if they were beaten, whipped, and hung. Now, how could you stand with a master knowing that he might be beating and whipping your first cousin, and he's out there raping your wife whenever he wanted to, or any of the overseers, but you still stand there and okay that with the master? Over 20,000 soldiers served in the Navy during the Civil War. And a lot of these men got no accolades. We know about all the regiments, black regiments and different things that fought, but, you know, sometimes we forget that over 20,000 that fought in the Navy. And when I look at the casualties of what the Civil War went through for black families, not only the loss of lives of maybe 180,000 on the battlefield, because we'll never know the correct number, because do you honestly think that they walked out there and counted every black body that was laying in the field? How many was wounded? How many was captured? And how many was missing? So when we look at the support personnel of all those black women and nurses and field hands and of children that were contraband, you know, to the Union forces, I would say we probably had close, they say about 300,000. I say half a million or more.
The number I have is 800,000. 800,000.
Yeah. That sounds about more like it. That sounds like more like it. So, but how many of those, you know, even free, lost their lands and possessions and household goods and money, and that was left in Confederate banks in the South as they fled? You know, that's a travesty, you know, there in black history. And we have to realize so much has gone on, you know, to disrupt the black family, to tear it apart, so that when we go to vote, that a lot of us don't understand the importance of seeking out which party is trying to help you and which party don't care about you. And you have to realize it is all a game, regardless if they had 10 parties, because do you think any of those 10 would truly help you? So when we get back to all the stuff that's going on, I really want, you know, Mr. McBride to talk about this thing about reparations. We have a candidate here for governor who I won't even mention his race because it's embarrassing, but said that we need to pay white Americans reparations, that our women shouldn't have the right to vote, and that African Americans in this country should not have that right to vote. So, I mean, when our kids are pushed with this, you know, this outrageous, you know, tactics of destroying our right to vote, you know, it bothers me greatly. And I'd like to talk to one of my seniors, you know, about this, because right now I need senior leadership. You know, before I go out here and speak and talk to anyone, I need that senior leadership that only a man like you could give me. So definitely, you know, cover some of, you know, the things I said, cover some of all the things I said, but I'll leave that in your court. And I thank you.
And thank you. Thank you.
Well, Mr. O'Brien, I wanted you to talk about, yeah, the reparations. Okay.
Oh, reparations? I'm not the guy for that. I believe in self-determination. I want, considerable control of the governing mechanism, wherever I am, whatever level, local, state, federal. That's what I'm gunning for. That's what you get control of that, there won't be any question of reparations or anything. I don't believe that there would be, unless you're like these these. You're with the guys up in New York who were so greedy that once they got elected, took charge of party affairs. First thing they went for was the treasury and started putting it in their own pockets. No, Claude Anderson has a pretty good take. You need to have that this great burst. Yeah, when I say burst, that means bank bank account or whatever. Available resources that would come together as a collectivity and not individual checks here and there. You do your planning and development around that vast amount. Feed everybody, housing, clothing, prosperity, education. Individually, I know that every time we got those checks here in Mississippi, we've got about 16 riverboat gambling casinos, and they did splendidly when we got those checks from the federal government, three, four different occasions, and that's fairly predictable for any individual checks that's given out in term from a reparations program that might be in tow or come out eventually. This is one thing that I would like to talk about that we missed, and if you indulge me, and that is the great number of Medal of Honor winners in the Civil War, Black Medal of Honor winners, 26 total. One of them was a native of Natchez, Mississippi. I think it was in the Battle of Mobile Bay. I'm not totally sure, but there were at least 16 Black Medal of Honor winners at the Battle of New Market Heights in Virginia, just northeast of Petersburg. And kind of south of Richmond, New Market Heights and Claflin Farms. Total of 16 new Medal of Honor winners there within a very short period. I think it was in September 1864. And February or March of 1863. And this was on the road to the capture of Richmond. And those were Black troops marching into Richmond to take charge of that city after the defeat of Robert E. Lee. So 26 total Medal of Honor winners. And, you know, we spoke early into the discussion about what's the difference between, say, 179,000 uniformed Black soldiers scattered across 175 regiments all across the South and going into Texas and all, and 29,000 Navy personnel, Black naval personnel. How can you follow this line of, I think it was 200,000 Black men and women in Texas waiting around for General Granger to come on June 19th, 1865, 3 months after the end, well, 2 months after the end, official end of the Civil War. And they were waiting around for a white man to come in on a mule. That's what somebody said. That's why he was so slow getting here. To let them know that, hey, you know, you have been freed by white men who fought for your liberation. Not dealing with the reality that you had four Black regiments that had just been sent there in March or April. No, it was, you know, April and May by General Phil Sheridan, who was in command of the Western forces. He's in New Orleans. He's the one who sent General Granger to Galveston or wherever it was, sent the Black troops there to seal off the escape route that the Confederates had going into Mexico. And you've got these thousands of black troops along with the white Union forces also. They're 2 months before the so-called Juneteenth. And you've got to wait until June 19th for that diktat to tell you that that you're free. Something is not right there. Something just 800,000. We've talked about 800,000 black men, women, and children, and then the 208,000 black soldiers and sailors. That's over 1 million people actively engaged with the hands on the steering wheel of the Civil War. And you're going to tell them that they didn't know they were free until June 19th, after the war was over? I can't believe it. I cannot process that. And anyway, that's the one thing I want you to understand is that we had 26, maybe more, but I'm counting 26 Medal of Honor, Congressional Medal of Honor winners. It was not called the Congressional Medal of Honor at that time, but it was the equivalent. And so that's where I am, and that's a precious memory that I encourage everybody to take. Because if you don't give the black men and women the credit for liberating themselves, something's wrong with you. I don't get it.
Okay, Brother Earnings, in closing out this topic for today's program, I think you may want to touch on the question of why General Phil Sheridan was so important in bringing and finding an end to the Civil War. And you want to talk maybe a little bit about, was there an African tradition of commemoration of the Civil War victory at Vicksburg, and what happened to it to that tradition at the end?
Okay. I mentioned General Sheridan. Phil Sheridan was this guy on horseback, and he's very, very important to the conclusion of the Civil War. He was commander, certain division, or, but anyway, he was shipped different places. You find him over there in not in Richmond, but at the time that Robert E. Lee surrenders. He's there on the battlefield, leading the battlefield. I think he participated in the Battle of Petersburg and all. You see, that went on for almost a year, Petersburg, very complicated, and wound up in New Market Heights, and then Cleveland. It was Cleveland Farm, and then into Richmond. But he was there, and then they called him out after Lee surrendered. Then they posted him back in New Orleans to take care of the Army of the West. All right, so there he was. That was the general headquarters for all the activities that was going down across the Trans-Mississippi, it was called, in the West. And so he came up with the plan that, okay, the Confederates are fleeing into Mexico. In fact, they were given a welcome into Mexico by Maximilian. He was an Austrian prince who had been installed as the king or emperor of Mexico over Juarez, the Native American president of Mexico, the first one. They had the French and the Austrians had decided that they were going to take Mexico from Juarez and the Mexican people. So they sent their armies and all, and so they were defeating Juarez and the Mexican army. And the Confederates, after the end of the Civil War, they were taking their cows and all their whatever they could steal, they were taking it across the border into Mexico. And they were expecting to be given a safe haven and quarters, and also alliance with the French and Austrian intruders there. And so that's why Phil Sheridan was there in New Orleans, and he's dispatching his forces, 30-some thousand men, along the border of Mexico, and then certain outposts in western Texas. And General Granger just happens to be one of those commanders that he sent into, what's the name of the town? It's not the where the Juneteenth thing was supposed to have taken place. But Granger was just one of a number of commanders who had been sent there. But the real action was among those four black regiments that were sent in to put down the last efforts of the Confederacy and also to block off the Mexican border. And how black people could miss that, I don't know. But to me, it's a legitimate holiday in Texas because they declared it a legitimate holiday in Texas. But for those of us who have relatives who are buried in the cemeteries here in either Natchez or Vicksburg especially, to say that black people did not have an awareness of the Civil War or the end of the Civil War is an insult to me. Yeah. What was the other point? That was Phil Sheridan's role. Yeah, of course, you know that Phil Sheridan was also given the reputation of killing off the Native American population after the Civil War in order to allow white people to take over the Western territory of the United States. And they had two black regiments, I believe. No, it was four black regiments, two cavalry and two infantry that were employed in that despicable genocide. And you had the 9th and the 10th, and then you had cavalry, and you had the 24th and 25th infantry. And a lot of the focus has been on the 10th Cavalry because they had Buffalo as their guidon, as their insignia on their flag, their guidon, as it's called. And so people want to call them Buffalo Soldiers. No. They lie and they say the Indians call them that. We have accurate records from American Indian historians, PhDs, who said, no, their people never called these black men Buffalo Soldiers. And the only possibility, according to Harry Jones, who was the rector of he was the head of the African American Civil War Museum in Washington before he died. But he said the only possibility of their being called Buffalo Soldiers was because some of them came out of Buffalo, New York, but there was no such thing as Buffalo Soldiers in the actual West, after the Civil War. This is all a fiction. This is like a Juneteenth, a national Juneteenth is a fiction also. So that's where we are right now.
And closing out, Brother Ernest, just give us an overview on African soldiers in the U.S. Civil War and how people didn't get in contact with you. They like for you to come to their cities, their schools, their institutions to share the many histories of our people's struggle that you have engaged in. How can they reach out to you? How can they support your work? And just give us your final thought on the subject tonight.
Well, I would say we can go online to the Jackson Advocate. Jackson Advocate Online. You'll see a lot of my work there. And just follow through, contact the Jackson Advocate, and they forward it on to me. And I have a post office box, too, Vicksburg, Mississippi, 39181, post office box 2, Vicksburg, Mississippi, 39181. But the best bet is to go online to the Jackson Advocate online, Jackson Advocate newspaper online, and you can get in contact with me through them, through the Advocate. I do have a phone number. I don't mind giving out 769-203-1008, 769-203-1008. Call me if you'd like, but, that's probably the least efficient way of handling this sort of stuff. I'd rather have you go online and read the Jackson Advocate. Got some really interesting stuff on the Congo for this week and the previous week. I would love for people to read that. It's being posted. Most of it is there now. And we have a wonderful Women's History Month edition that just came out Thursday. So there we are. Anything else I can help with, brother?
No, just give us your final thoughts on what you want our people to remember the most from the discussion tonight. What should they take from the discussion?
Okay, what I would like to have remembered is that in the Mississippi Valley, where most of the Civil War, the critical Civil War took place, that's where most of your black soldiers were recruited in the Mississippi Valley. And Vicksburg became the garrison, and I think he had about 15 different black regiments to pass through or be stationed at Vicksburg, Mississippi, at some point between July 4th, 1863, and all the way up to the reformulation of the black regiments when they, I think it was 1867, 69. 2 years after the war, 66 years or so after the war, that Vicksburg was like the great harvest of the black troops in the Civil War. That's where they were. And I'd like for you to remember that we had 26 Medal of Honor winners, black Medal of Honor winners from the Civil War. And this is no bull jump. These are not men sitting around or just picking cotton or whatever it is, waiting for General Granger. I like that image of him riding in on his mule to announce to the black people in the field that they are free now, because that's why he was so slow getting there, because he's riding a mule, which is ridiculous. But it makes about as much sense as it does to say that black people knew nothing about the Civil War, and so you have a national holiday called Juneteenth that they knew nothing about their own destiny, their own participation, their own ancestors, and so they just embrace whatever fiction is passed on to them, and that's where we are. That's what I want people to remember.
And on that note, we'd like to thank Brother Ernest McBride for sharing his narrative, his perspective, and helping us to fill out the missing pages of African/black soldiers in the U.S. Civil War. We would like to remind everybody that this program come on a bi-weekly basis. Our next program will be April the 13th at 1 p.m. Please spread the word, share the word, and help us increase our listenership. For the next 2-3 months, we'd like to see if we can get our listenership up to over 100,000 people. So on that note, what we're going to do, we're going to take a station break. And when we come back, we're going to have a special message from the community from Brother Alex. And then we have announcements on how you can support MPH. This is the voice of MPH Radio. We'll be right back.
Enough of the sergeant!
themselves, they don't care about us. If they don't care about us, the real question is, do you care about us? That's the most important question. You welcome everyone back to MPH Radio. In our closing out of this program, the missing pages of Africans / Black soldiers in the U.S. Civil War, we may make our transition to a message to our community from Brother Alex Joyner. We will now turn the mic over to him. Brother Alex, the mic is yours.
Well, again, Brother Lee, I have to say one more time, you brought us some information today that made these past hours well worth my time here on Saturday, because I've learned a lot of information, you know, from Mr. McBride, and that's what it should be. You know, we are on the air to, you know, promote information and knowledge, and these missing, you know, topics, these missing people out of our history that we have to know about, because sooner or later someone may start, not only just it'll be missing, but it'll be forgotten forever. So on that note, I would like to say the Yankees are coming. We need a civil war to stop them. I was startled last week by this comment made by a middle-aged European-American woman at a Medicare and Social Security meeting, since many Republican members in the U.S. Congress are voting to end the entitlements programs of Abraham Lincoln, Franklin D. Roosevelt, John F. Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, James Carter, William Clinton, Barack Obama, and Joseph Biden. The Republican Party has always tried to end these programs since Roosevelt's administration because they benefit the lowest income people in America. The Yankees, as she exclaimed, were workers and retirees moving south and causing an increase of the property values and taxes. They were asking for better roads and schools to be built along with rent increases and higher wages. They wanted to celebrate Black holidays and history. The Yankees had caused the old Southern Civil War monuments to be toppled and moved to graveyards, and she was not happy about that. These were heroes and past family members who had fought for over 100 years for her privileged way of life, and now it was being threatened. These northern carpetbaggers were causing trouble in her neighborhood, and she felt a second civil war was needed. As she talked for about 20 minutes about how her European ancestors fought to make the United States a country, she never mentioned the countless sacrifices that were made by millions of slaves and freemen who died in every engagement, from the French and Indian Wars of the British or at Concord and Lexington. Nor did she mention General Washington's Black Regiment or General Patton's armored tank units, the real Black Panthers. Once she was done venting, I quietly stood up and gave everyone present a history lesson on why the Civil War was fought, the major players, and the troops, white and black. They gave their lives for a better America than the privileged has tried to stop. A second civil war for justice and equality, social media, and the daily news have been calling a second civil war is brewing in America. The ideas and beliefs that started the first war remain the same in America today, almost 160 years later. It is still the same. What to do with Negro rights in America? Since the Negroes were left out of the original Declaration of Independence, U.S. Constitution, and the Bill of Rights as U.S. citizens, how are they to be absorbed by amendments and their rights to be protected by others who would not accept any law that makes them equal citizens under the law? So if the law isn't enforced, what rights do they have? Freedom from oppression and illegal bondage was what many slaves sought as they signed up for the Union Army. They fought to enjoy the liberty and freedom of the land their fathers and forefathers had fought for from Great Britain, France, and Spain. And now the foe was the white Southern plantation owners and the state and local governments who sought to keep them as slaves forever. They realized that their blood must now be spilled upon the ground, so history would record that the ones in bondage joined the Yankees and fought for their freedom. Freedom was not given to these people called slaves by only an act of a vote or a pen, but dried blood on the battlefields from black skins showed that the world that they were brave and honorable men. Their sacrifice was for the generations not born, so they would not know the atrocity of slavery and servitude. These men and women were our ancestors who did not fear giving their lives for future generations. There were over 600,000 soldiers, men and women of free and former runaway slaves and contraband, enslaved people who fought in the Civil War. Over 180,000 were listed to serve as soldiers on the battlefield, and over 10,000 died of battle wounds, and 30,000 died of illness or infection. They accounted for over 10% of the total Union troop fighting force, and they fought with distinction. An additional 20,000 men served in the U.S. Navy. Their support turned the tide in the fight for freedom against the ones who held them in bondage. The former slaves and freedmen proved that they were willing to die for freedom and liberty as the fight was about them. They understood that if captured, they would be executed on the spot and not taken as a prisoner of war. Their white commanders would die also for inciting a servitude insurrection. So many chose to die as a man fighting was right and honorable. They demonstrated an unmatched skill in scouting, riding, and marksmanship that showed that they were the best of the best when it came to warfare. I would like to mention just a few of these black Civil War heroes, such as Alexander Augustus, born free in Maryland. He became the highest-ranking black officer during the war. He was the first out of 8 black surgeons that was in the Union Army. He was even physically attacked for wearing his officer's uniform when he came home to Baltimore, Maryland. In 1890, he was the first black officer to be buried in Arlington National Cemetery with full honors. Abraham Galloway was an enslaved slave who returned back to the South to free more people, including his mother and family. He became a soldier for the Union and a master spy, as he reported movement and stolen battle plans and information from Confederate forces. He never learned to read or write, but his skills of common sense and bravery were unmatched. In 1868, he became a state senator in North Carolina, helping to ratify the 14th and 15th Amendments for the state. Robert Smalls' daring escape from the slavery into the hands of the Union Navy was a made-for-Hollywood movie story. He was the son of a white plantation owner and an enslaved woman. Later, he became a sailor. He slipped the ship named Planter out of the Charleston Harbor with 16 slaves hiding on board to the freedom of the Union ships blockading the harbor. He was commissioned a brigadier general in the South Carolina militia and elected to the State House and Senate. Finally, Susie King Taylor, born into slavery but escaped with her uncle and others and began to teach other runaways and freedmen to read and write. She became a nurse in the Civil War, but trained others to learn how to shoot a rifle and to hit the center target. She wrote letters home for many and married an officer herself. In 1902, she was the first and only African-American woman to write a memoir called Reminiscences of My Life in Camp with the 33rd United States Colored Troops, Carolina Volunteers. I can never stop appreciating these men, women, and children who gave their lives fighting so that I could be in the position I am in today as an American citizen. The fight is not over. It is a continuing fight to keep this treasured history alive before it is removed, destroyed, or legislated out of existence. The recruit of the United States Colored Troops was, "Come join us, brothers, for freedom." And again, thank you, Mr. Lee. It's been an honor to even be part of this show today.
We'd like to thank you, Brother Alex. We'd like to thank our brother, Ernest McBride. We'd like to thank all our listening audience who allowed this program to come into their homes as we continue to share information that will help move humanity forward. We'd like to remind all those who may live in the Richmond metro area of the state of Virginia that they can watch MPH historical live TV shows on Comcast Channel 95 and Verizon Channel 36 on the weekends on every Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at 1 a.m. We also like to remind those who listen who like to join MPH Radio as a support group and support this institution that you can write us at mphradio@yahoo.com as well as make a donation to support this station by Zelle, which is Missing Pages of History 1 at yahoo.com, or you can direct mail in your contribution to Missing Pages of History, Inc., P.O. Box 27782, Richmond, Virginia 23261. Our next program will be on Saturday, April the 13th at 1 p.m. Please join in and spread the word. So until next time, we will continue to strive to go forever and fill in our missing pages of history. And today, we would like to thank all of y'all who are participants of filling in the missing pages of Africans / Black soldiers in the U.S. Civil War. We see you on April the 13th, and remember, MPH is here for you. We see you on April the 13th. This is the voice of MPH Radio.
Save the nation with no support for education. 'Cause Right now it don't make sense. Right now it don't make sense. Let's talk about our part. My heart touch your heart. Let's talk about living. Had enough of dying. That's what we all about. Let's do more giving. Do more forgiving. Yeah. Our souls are brought together so that we can love each other. Sister, we are here. We are here.
the Beatles' new record again.
And the only safe place to live is on an Indian reservation.
And the band played on.
Eve of destruction, tax deduction.
Inspectors, bill collectors,
all growing in the man population out of hand.
Suicide, too many bills, hippies moving to the hills. People all over the world are shouting into war.
And the band played on.
one would you choose, my brothers? If there was no day or night, which would you prefer to be right? How long have you hated your white teacher? Who told you you loved your black preacher? Do you respect your brother's woman friend and share with black folks not of kin? People must prove to the people
a better day is coming
for you and for me. With just a little bit more education
and love for our nation,
would make a better society. Now some of us would rather cuss and make a fuss than to bring about a little trust. But we shall overcome, I believe, someday, if you'll only listen to what I have to say.
And how long have you held your white teacher?
Who told you you love your black preacher? Can you respect your brother's woman friend and share with black folks not of kin? I say now people must prove to the people
a better day is coming
for you and for me. With just a little bit more education
and love for our nation,
would make a better society. And if you had a choice of colors, which one would you choose, my brothers? If there was no day or night, which would you prefer to be right? And if you had a choice of colors, which one would you choose, my brothers? If there was no day or night, which would you prefer to be right? If you had a choice of colors, which